on page Yudches in Yevamos, the last words of the page, middle of Ois Mem Aleph. We're in the middle of learning the story about what happened with David and the Givonim. So to recap, there was a famine. David checked out over the few years what kind of Averis they're doing, didn't find any. He asks the Rumatumim, and he's told two things. El Shol, Vel Beis Adomim, Ala Shehemis Es HaGivonim, because of Shol, and because of the house of blood, because he killed the Givonim. So we said that that he killed the Givonim wasn't directly, it was indirect, because he killed, he wiped out Noiv Ir HaKoyanim, and therefore the Givonim suffered from that. As far as El Shol, we said, was the fact that they hadn't done a proper hesped for him many years earlier when he passed away. And for those two reasons, the Urim V'Tumim are telling him is why we have the famine. Amar David, so David says to himself, Shol, as far as the matter with Shol and his hesped, look, Nofkulahu Tresi Yachishata, 12 months have already passed. Now, a lot more than 12 months have passed. By this time, it's about 30 years since Shol was killed. But the point is, in other words, the cupboard of the mess is to do the hesped within a maximum of 12 months. After that, it's not really becoming dick for him anymore, because Rashi brings, because at that point already people have already accepted Tanchumen for the mess. While the Gemara points out elsewhere that after a while people forget the mess. This is a chesed the Eibishter, so they're not always constantly obsessed by the memory of him. So after 12 months, he tends to be forgotten to a certain extent, and therefore you don't do a spading. So by now it's years and years later. So David says it's really too late for that. So it's not derech eretz dik to make a hesped for Shol now. Now, you have to ask, though, Hashem told him through the Urim V'Tumim, El Shol, that Shol was not nispad ka'alocha. What is David second-guessing Hashem? Okay, Hashem said you said it was a problem, but it's too late to do anything about it. So a couple of them before Hashem address different possibilities with it. The Maharal then gives a couple of explanations. One of them is that David figured, what the Urim V'Tumim means by that is that we want to stress, even though Hashem is holding Shol to account for the fact that he caused harm to the Givonim, as we learned before, nevertheless, the Eibishter wants you to know, don't think he lost his place in Olam Haba or something. No, he still is a tzaddik, and he deserved a hesped in his time, but you're right, it's too late to do anything about it now, David figured. So that would be one. So in other words, David is not second-guessing Hashem, but he's reinterpreting and understanding that Hashem is not saying do a hesped now, because that would be on the face of it, a lack of derech eretz, but rather that it means you should have been aware at the time that he needed a hesped, and even now you should realize he was a great tzaddik, and even many years later now, Hashem still is bringing that point up. The Rif over here makes another point as well, that David figured, first let's take care of the matter of the Givonim, because it's an immediate matter. Right now, they're still suffering. Let's see if that's enough. Maybe that's enough already. And after all, maybe the fact that we take care of the matter of the Givonim, that will also take care of the matter that we didn't show proper respect to Shol. Like, the two things will kind of go together. When he saw, even after the whole thing with the Givonim, as we're going to tell the rest of the story, that still the rain wasn't falling yet, then he realized we still need to take care of the hesped of Shol. But even then, what he did is, as the pasuk goes on to describe, they had to rebury Shol and his sons anyway, because after Shol and his sons had been killed in battle against the Plishtim, the Psukim describe over there, the Plishtim took their bodies and they were hanging them up on the walls to be able to show everybody, look, we beat the Jewish king. The people of Yavish Gila, the city across the Yarden, sneaked in there and stole the bodies and then took the bodies and buried them in Yavish Gila. But still, it's not Bekovedik. They should be buried over there in Avra Yarden, in a place that's not even part of their Shevet's territory. So now, after all this, David figured, let's go take the bodies, bury them in a more bekovedik way in Shol's family plot in the territory of Binyamin. And then once we're doing that already, then it's reasonable to be doing a hesped at that time, because then the body is being reburied. So that would be, in other words, that was David's thought process over here. Anyway, so David thinks to himself, Nisinim, as far as the Nisinim, the Givonim, fine, Nikrinu v'Nifaisinu, fine, let's call them together, and let's try to appease them, let's try to get them to be Moichel Shol, so that rain will fall. So sure enough, as the pasuk says, Vayikra Melech, so the king called for the Givonim and he said to them, and then at this point is where the pasuk interjects the part that we said before, that we quoted at the beginning of the sugya, that they're not part of the Jewish people. That was actually the outcome of this whole thing, as we're going to go on to say, that because they showed themselves to be cruel, then David realized they can never fully join the Jewish people. But then, so he said, he called together the Givonim and he asked them, Ma asa lachem, what can I do for you? How can we atone for what Shaul did to you? And this way you will bless the heritage of Hashem. In other words, that you'll be moichel and the Eibishter will allow the rain to fall. So, the Givonim answered to him, look, we have no claim of silver or gold against Shaul and his family, and we don't want to go and just take revenge indiscriminately against Jews. Instead, they say, Yutan lono shiva anoshim mibonav, there should be given to us seven men from among his descendants. Why seven? We'll talk about in a second. And we will hang them in honor of Hashem. Like, in other words, they're saying basically we want blood because we Givonim suffered and went hungry and whatever, as we learned yesterday. Therefore, we want to take it out on Shaul's descendants and kill seven of them. So Paisinu, so David tried to talk them out of that. What are you going to gain? What are you going to gain by that? Veloy mefaisu, and they wouldn't be appeased. In fact, there's an interesting thing in the pasuk that the Gemara, one of the pasukim the Gemara is quoting over here, where they say Ein lonu kesef v'zahav, we have no claim of gold or silver. There's actually a kri uksiv over there. The kri is the way we have it over here in the Gemara, lonu to us in general, but the ksiv is li in the singular, meaning the Medrash says David went around to every individual Givoni saying, you know what, here, why don't I offer you some gold and silver and you give up this claim and you give up this cool claim against Shaul and his descendants. And not one of them was willing to do that. Every single one of them, Li and Lonu, both of them in the individual and the collective, are saying, no, we want blood. Why Dafka are they demanding seven? So some of the Mephoshim bring from a Medrash actually that there were seven. We talked about yesterday what happened to the Givonim in the first place. Here the Gemara says that they were indirectly affected because the Koyanim of Noi were killed. Therefore the Givonim lost their Panosa, as we talked about yesterday, or as Maharsha says, they lost the source to serve the Koyanim and to serve in the Beis Hamikdash. But there is actually a Medrash that says that seven of them were killed. So when Doeg was killing the Kohenim, then accidentally he also killed seven Givonim. So that would be one reason why they're demanding seven. There's also sources that say, here the Gemara is going to explain soon how they picked the seven. And there are sources that say that those seven that ended up being picked and ended up being killed are Taka the ones who many years earlier had assisted Shaul in and Doeg in killing those Kohenim of Noiv. So therefore, in that sense, then now it's coming back to them. Ion Yaakov also says that that we find seven a lot of times in connection with punishment, Shiva Mador to Gehenim, for example. So that would be another reason why they're demanding seven. Anyway, so David thinks to himself, Amar David, Gimel Simonim Yesh Ba'umazu. This nation, the Jewish people, have three Simonim, three basic Midas, Tovis. Rachmanin Ubaishonin V'goim Lachsadim. A Yid is naturally merciful and has a sense of shame. And do chesed. So we know we see in each of these in Pesukim, the Alter Rebbe, by the way, mentions at the end of Perek Aleph of Tanya that these are so ingrained in a Jew that actually they don't even come from the Nefesh HaLekis. They come from a Yid's Nefesh HaBahamas naturally has these traits in them, as opposed to, as he's going to go on to say, the other nations do not. And we know that these three are characteristic of Jews. Rachmanin, dichtiv, v'nosan l'cha rachmim, v'richam l'cha v'hirbecha. The pasuk says, Hashem will give you rachmim, and he will have rachmanus on you, and he will increase you. So we see that Hashem implanted rachmim within the Jewish people.
Maybe that's to make up for the ear.
The context over there is the Irani Dachas, right? We're having to wipe out an entire city, right? So there's an explanation that after that, the person would naturally bring about a streak of cruelty within a person that he just went and helped wipe out a whole city, and therefore the Eibush is promising that he's going to reinforce your natural midah of Rachmanus, so it won't have that effect, right? But we see from that a Yid has a natural midah of Rachmanus. By Shonin, where do we see that a Yid is naturally bashful and has a sense of shame? Moshe says to the Jewish people by Matan Torah that Hashem made you had you experience the Matan Torah and the Gilui Shechina over there, so that the fear of Hashem should constantly be on your face, and therefore that refers to Busha particularly. Because Busha and Yira are recognizable on a person's face, which is why you have the expression Boshes Panim. So therefore, that means that a Yid naturally has that sense. Which, by the way, Maharsha points out in this connection, elsewhere the Gemara says in Beitza that the Jewish people are Azin Shabbat Omos, and Az is often the most brazen of the nations, and Azin is often taken as the opposite of Boshes, like Az Ponim L'Gehenim or Boshes Ponim L'Gan Eden. So what it means is, in other words, Maharsha explains, you're right, we Jewish people have a natural sense of Azus. But because the Ebishter gave us the Torah, that in turn implanted in us a corresponding busha that helps control and moderate that azus. The Gemara, in fact, says there in Beitza that if it weren't for the Torah having been given to us Jewish people, nobody else would be able to tolerate us because of the azus panim. With that said, when we learned this in Beitza, we talked about various other points as well, that we still have the azus panim now, which is we have the strength and the fortitude to be able to withstand all of the challenges that the goyim and that everything throw at us. So in that sense, we still have the azus ponim, but on the other hand, we have the sense of busha that a yid feels a natural sense of embarrassment about doing an aveira or at least about being caught in it and so forth. And goyim lechsodim tichtiv, we find that Hashem speaks about Avraham. He says, "Well, manashi tzaves bonaves beise achrav goymer." That I love Avraham because he teaches his children and descendants after him that they and then the pasuk continues that they keep derech Hashem, and derech Hashem refers to gemilas chasadim. We know that Maharsha says, because after all, we learn the concept that a yid should do gemilas chasadim. We learn that the pasuk says, "Achrei Hashem al kechem teleichu," you should follow in the ways of Hashem, and just like Hashem does gemilas chasadim, as the Gemara points out, the Torah, almost the first thing in the Torah is gemilas chasadim, Hashem giving Adam and Chava clothing, and almost the last thing in the Torah is gemilas chasadim, Hashem burying Moshe. So therefore, we learn from that we should do gemilas chasadim also. So we see, in other words, that gemilas chasadim is called derech Hashem, and Hashem gives Avraham a compliment that he teaches his children that. So therefore we see these three midas are implanted within the Jewish people. So there are various Mephoshim talk about that why Davka these three things. The Maharal explains that each one of them corresponds to one of the Ovos. Gemilas Chasadim to Avraham, we know he was the paragon of Chesed. Yira and Busha to Yitzchak, and then Rachmonim to Yaakov. Those also relate to the three midas of Chesed, Gvura, and Tiferes that they exemplify, and so forth. Even Yaakov points out other things as well. We know there's a whole bunch of threes in connection with the giving of the Torah, as it mentions in Masechta Shabbos, that three-part Jewish people, Kohenim, Levim, Yisraelim, in the third month, the third day of preparation, and so on and so forth. So here also there's three simanim. Anyway, so David thinks to himself, Kol mish yesh begimel simon and halalu. So anybody who has those three simon and who has those three midas, royally Davik boy, is worthy, is fitting to join up with the Jewish people. But if he doesn't have these three simonim, ain royally David boy, then it's not suitable to join up with them. And therefore, this is the point when David made the gzera that the givonim can never intermarry into the Jewish people. Now, further on, the Gemara is going to talk about, wasn't there already a gzera on that from before? So we touched on that yesterday when we started the story, and the Gemara is going to explain, and we'll talk about later on what Tosfos has to say on it. In any case, that was. So therefore, that is why the Pasuk, when it introduces the Givonim in the story, it says, "Va'givonim loy b'minei Yisrael hema." That is actually David's declaration after this whole thing took place, that the Givonim can never be part of B'nai Yisrael because they showed themselves to be cruel in this case. Now, an interesting point in that regard is, so we see they don't have the Midah of Rachmonim. Do we see also that they don't have the Midah of Baishanim and Goyim Lechzodim? On the face of it, it means they're lacking one thing. So in fact, Eitz Yosef brings this concept that if a person doesn't have these three midas, also comes up in halacha, where it says, based on that, it's brought in halacha, that if you find a yid who lacks these three qualities, then it's better not to make a shidduch with him, because he may not be Mizarei Shel Avraham, he may not be descended from legitimate Jews, as we're saying over here. So now the Beis Shmuel, one of the major Noisa Kelim on Shulchan Aruch, Evan Ezer, points out that if it was only that a person was lacking one of the midas, that wouldn't necessarily bar him from joining the Jewish people. Here on the face of it, it's only one, but no, he says it's actually all three. Because obviously they showed they didn't have rachmanus because they're being cruel and they just want to have people killed. They also lack baishonim. They also lack the quality of busha, because here again David is going to each one of them individually and trying to talk them into don't do this and instead be willing to accept monetary compensation or something. And not one of them did. So that shows they don't have busha, because a person should naturally have a yid should naturally have the sense of a sense of shame like that, to not go and brazenly toss off such a thing. And as far as Gemilas Chasadim, look, it's already 30 years already. They should have long since given up any claim to such thing, and that would be a chesed, and they didn't, so it actually shows that they're lacking all three middos. Okay. So the Pasuk says that there's no choice. David realizes if this is the only way that the Givonim are going to be appeased, then this is what we're going to have to do. In fact, the Pasuk, so the Gemara doesn't quote the Pasuk over here, but actually there's the Pasuk says, Vayomer ham, interesting, after the Givonim make that demand of theirs, you have in many editions of Tanakh, you have at that point a piska be'emtza Pasuk. You have a break in the middle of a parasha psucha in the middle of a Pasuk. So it's almost like the Givonim have made such a shocking thing. Like David has to like almost take a moment to collect his wits. Like, did they really say that? And then, okay, we have no choice. And the Pasuk says that David says, fine, I'm going to hand him over. The Malbim, by the way, makes an interesting point over there. Why ani etain? Just etain means I will give. It means I, in my role as king, have the right to do that, even though according to the regular din, they shouldn't be chayev misa. There's no Edim, there's no Asra, there's no nothing, but because Din HaMalchus, because a king is empowered, Api Halacha, to act in certain ways beyond the regular dictates of Halacha, then therefore David says, in my role as king, Ani Etain, I will make sure that this happens. So the pasuk says, "Vayikach HaMelech Shnei Bnei Ritzpa Basaya Asher Yoldu L'Shol." So David took the two sons of Ritzpa Bas Aya, whom she had born to Shaul. Ritzpa Bas Aya, we find she comes up earlier in Sefer Shmuel. She was a Pilegesh a common law wife of Shaul, and he or she had born him these two sons. So Shaul also had a regular, a full-fledged wife, and he had children with her, but then there was this Ritzpa Bas Aya. So the two sons were as Hamuni Ves Mifiboshes. We'll talk about in a minute who this Mifiboshes was. And then in addition, to fill out the rest of the seven, David took the five sons of Michal Bas Shol, Asher Yodel Adriel ben Barzillai HaMecholosi, whom she had born to Adriel ben Barzillai from Mecholo. Actually, the earlier in Sefer Shmuel, it comes out that actually Michal was actually David's wife. So you have the whole story where David had married her, and then eventually after David ran away, Shaul decided that the Kiddushin had been invalid, and he married her off to someone else named Palti ben Laish, and the Gemara tells in Sanhedrin how he heroically fought his Yetzirah all the years and never came close to her because he figured there's a good chance that she's still an Eishes Ish. Eventually, she was returned to David. So where does this Adriel come in? So actually, earlier in Sefer Shmuel, you have that Michal's elder sister, Merav, was married to this Adriel. What happened was, the Pesukim described, after David had defeated Goliath, and part of the deal was that he's going to be able to marry the king's daughter. So at first, there was going to be a shidduch made with Merav, the elder daughter, but in the event, she ended up marrying this Adriel instead, and that's when instead David went and made a shidduch, and Shaul arranged a shidduch between David and Michal. Anyway, the point is that these children are actually Merav's children. The Gemara explains in Sanhedrin, Merav passed away, and Michal, her younger sister, took over and fostered the children. And from that, we learn the fact that the Pasuk calls them her children. We learn from that that when a person raises somebody else's children, foster children, it's considered as though they bore them. So therefore, the Pasuk can describe that Michal bore them to Adriel, even though she's not the one who bore them. Her elder sister Merav was, because she raised them.
They are also his foster kids.
So they're David's foster kids also. This is true, yeah. Okay, so the question is, now, first of all, by the way, who is this Mephibosheth? Tosfos points out over here. Now, the thing is, there's two people in David's family named Mephibosheth. The Pasuk goes on to mention, and the Gemara is going to quote soon, that there was a Mephibosheth, the son of Jehonasan. Now, we know there was Jehonasan, the good friend of David. They had made a shavua that they would always be faithful to one another, and David continued to keep that shavua even after Jehonasan had passed away. So this Mephibosheth then evidently is another one, as we're saying over here. He's a grandson of Shaul. So in other words, in short, there were two Mephibosheths in the family. There was a Mephibosheth both of them were grandsons of. The Mephibosheth was saying over here was actually a son of Shaul. Was saying he's a son of Shaul from his Pilegesh Ritzpa Bas Aya. So it comes out, in other words, there was an uncle and a nephew, both with the name Mephibosheth. There was Mephibosheth, the son of Shaul, and then there's Mephibosheth, the son of Jehonasan, the son of Shaul. Now, Tosfos discusses, in other places, the Gemara mentions that there was a Mephibosheth who was David's Rebbe. Now, on the now the Gemara is going to go. Now, the pasuk mentions over here that Mephibosheth was one of the seven who was killed. And on the other hand, Mephibosheth, so that's Mephibosheth, the son of Shaul. On the other hand, we're saying Mephibosheth, the son of Jehonasan, the grandson of Shaul, was spared. So Tosfos discusses that based on various Gemaras on the subject, the Mephibosheth, who was David's Rebbe, was apparently the first one, Shaul's son, not Shaul's grandson. In which case, then, that raises the question, why the Gemara is going to say soon, that as far as Mephibosheth, the son of Jehonasan, David davened on his behalf that he shouldn't be killed, that he shouldn't be one of the seven who's chosen. So why didn't he do that for the first Mephibosheth, the elder one, who's his own Rebbe? So Tosfos' answer is that look, he may have davened on his behalf, but Hashem didn't accept his tefillah for that. So as far as Mephibosheth, the son of Jehonasan, Hashem accepted his tefillah because after all, he had made a shavua to Jehonasan to protect him and his family. But as far as this Mephibosheth, the son of Shaul, he didn't have. So even though he had the schus, according to Tosfos, of being David's Rebbe, nevertheless, apparently that schus wasn't enough to save him from being killed. Okay. So anyway, so Maishnohani. So why Davka these seven?
The seventh again.
So we're saying that Mephibosheth, the two are Ammoni and Mephibosheth and the five sons of Michal. So that's 2 + 5. So Marshall says, I mean, what makes the Gemara assume that Shaul had any more living descendants at that point that the Gemara could ask who are the seven? We know, fine, Shaul originally had more children. He had four other children who are mentioned in the Pesukim. You have Jehonasan and two younger brothers of his who were all killed in battle against the Plishtim. And then you have Ish-bosheth, who was briefly king after Shaul passed away, after Shaul was killed, and then he himself was assassinated as well. But they were long gone. We don't know that they had any descendants among them, as it is earlier in Sefer in Shmuel Bey's Perek Tes. David has to ask, are there any more descendants of Shaul around that I want to do chesed with them? And then the only one he can find is Mephibosheth ben Jehonasan. So there aren't a lot of descendants of Shaul left at this point. So why is the Gemara asking Maishnahani, meaning what's so special about these seven? How many other possible candidates were there? So Marusha says that's exactly the point. Given that we have those awesome Mephibosheth ben Jehonasan, and the Pasuk goes on to say that he was saved in the end, then the question is, why was he saved and these seven were killed? Why wasn't he one of the seven? So Amar Rav Huna, Hevirum Lifnei Oren. What they did is they had all the possible candidates, all the living descendants of Shaul, all the living men at least, who are descendants of Shaul, pass in front of the Oren. Kolsha Oren Koltoi, anybody who the Oren would grab a hold of him, like he would be frozen in his place and he couldn't move, Lemissa, then that indicated that he's going to be one of the ones who are killed. Kolsha Ein Oren Koltoi, anybody whom the Oren would not grab and was able to walk free, Lachayim, then he would go on and he would live. So that's how they chose the seven. Now, what kind of thing is that? First of all, actually, a couple of them should bring over here from the Yerushalmi and from the Medrash that actually the test was the other way around. What they did is they use the Mizbeach, and they said whoever is grabbed by the Mizbeach and can't move are the ones who are spared. Because we find the Mizbeach, for example, you have a Ritzeach B'shoigig can grab a hold to the horns of the Mizbeach, and he's saved. It's like a miniature ear mikla. So therefore, and they had the same effect over here, that it saved them. And anybody who was able to walk away means the Mizbeach isn't going to protect him, and therefore he's one of the seven who's killed. So a different version that the Gemara has it over here. The Meshech Chochma actually gives an interesting point on it. He says that there's two different ways of looking at it. You look at it, the Oren is where Hashem's Shekhinah is. You have to be on a very, very high level to be able to be close to that. And if not, we know the Oren could be very dangerous if people approached it without the proper Kedusha. Therefore, our Gemara takes the view that whoever was grabbed by the Oren means that he's in trouble. He's like, so to speak, in the force field of the Oren, and he's the one who's going to be caught. Whereas on the other hand, the Mizbeach, he says, represents more the connection that individual Jews have with one another and us us on an individual and a collective level with Hashem. And therefore, that would be the Mizbeach. Then the Yerushalmi takes the view that the Mizbeach would be the instrument through which they were saved. And there's a lot of other, there's various Mephoshim talk about that these seven were basically a kapara on behalf of the Jewish people. We're saying the whole point was that they were killed, and therefore that brought the rain in the end and saved the whole Jewish people from famine. And in that sense, then that also connects with the idea that they were caught by the Oren, indicating, in other words, they're actually very high level Kedoshim, and they who deserve to be in a certain sense within the orbit of the Oren, but precisely for that reason, they're the ones who become the kapara for the Jewish people. Anyway, Masiv Rav Huna or Rav Chana Bar Ktina. So Rav Huna or Rav Chana Bar Katina asks, if you're telling me that they were chosen by the Oren, the pasuk continues, "Vayachmel Hamelach al Mephibosheth ben Yehonasan ben Shaul." That David had Rachmanus on Mephibosheth, the son of Yehonasan, the son of Shaul. Who again, as Tosfos has said before, that's not the same Mephibosheth who was his rebbe. That is though the Mephibosheth who was the son of his good friend Yehonasan. So, what do you mean Vayachmel Hamelach? What do you mean he had Rachmanus on him? If the Oren is deciding who gets caught and who not, then how is David overriding that? So the answer is Shaloi Ha'aviro. So you could say he didn't make him go in front of the Oren in the first place. So that way he's not caught, and that way he's spared. You got to ask though, Masay Ponim Yesh B'Davar. But since when? How are you allowed to show favoritism in such a way? What do you mean? It's a matter of dinin nefashis. You make everybody walk by. The Eibishter will decide who's going to be caught and who's not. What's it your business, David, to interfere with that and to say that one person shouldn't have to because you were good friends with his father? Okay, Ela Shehavir of a Kolte Oren. Rather, you can answer that this Mephibosheth was made to walk in front of the Oren as well. The Kolte Oren, and the Oren did in fact trap him. Ubikish all of Rachmin, but then David Davin on his behalf. Upolte, and then the Oren let him go. Still, still, isn't that also showing favoritism? Once he was already trapped by the Oren, and it has to be, remember, the Givonim are demanding seven people. So it means if he lets Mephibosheth go, it means that somebody else is going to be killed instead. How can he do such a thing? So Ella Shabikish Rachmim Shaloyik Latenu Ha'oren. Rather, what it means is that David Davin, that in the first place the Oren shouldn't trap him. Now that's much less of an issue. There's no Masi Ponim, for one thing, because nobody knows what David Davin privately. He Davin between himself and Hashem. So fine, Hashem listened to his tefillah and didn't allow this Mephibosheth to get caught in the first place. But that's not, it doesn't look like open favoritism to him, because nobody's gonna know that. There is a very interesting thing in this regard. The Iyun Yaakov and then Yad Yosef both quote a very interesting shach in this connection in Choshen Mishpat. You have a din there, it talks about in Shulchan Aruch, and the shach brings in this connection from a truva of Ma'ari ben Lev. Suppose you have a situation where the government is demanding that a certain number of rich people are going to contribute to some government project or whatever. We're going to force them to give contributions towards it. So he brings over there that before they've chosen who the people are going to be, then a person would be entitled to go and bribe them or buy his way out of it, and even if it means they're going to end up picking somebody else. It means then you're causing somebody else to have to suffer, but before they chose that it's going to be you, then you're entitled to get out of the situation. That would be similar to the way before they're walking in front of the Oren, David has the ability to daven on behalf of Mephibosheth that he shouldn't be chosen in the first place. But once the government says, you have to give, then a person doesn't have the right, says the Shach, based on the Ma'ari ben Lev, he doesn't have the right then to go and say, let me pay the officials some money under the table and they'll let me go of this and they'll choose somebody else, because that would be similar to what we're saying over here, Mephibosheth already being caught and then David davening for him to be released. You can't do that when it's at somebody else's expense, as it would be in that case. Now, so the question becomes, how though anyway are they killing people? Are they killing sons and grandsons of Shaul because of what he did wrong? Doesn't the pasuk say that children are not to be killed for the averus of their that fathers are not to be killed for the averus of their children and vice versa? Strictly speaking, Marsha says, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says the pasuk doesn't just mean in the simple sense that you don't punish parents for their children's averus and vice versa. What it really means, v'halacha, is that you can't. That it teaches us about the dinim of edus, the fact that you can't convict a person in Beis Din based on the testimony of his relatives, of his son or his father, of his son or his father, respectively. We learn that from the pasuk. But the pasuk finishes. The point is, so we're not really dashing from that part of the pasuk, but we're saying the pasuk ends ish becheter yumosu. Each person is to be killed for his own averus. So the question is, and now you do have the concept we have in Aseret Hadibros, Poiked Avon Oves Abonim, that Hashem remembers the averus of the ancestors for their children. But that's when Uichzin Masei Avesein Biyadeim, as the Gemara explains in various places, that it means when they continue to act, when they continue to do the same averus that their ancestors did. So then the Eibishter takes the punishment that would have gone to their ancestors and brings it on them as well. But here you don't have that. Shaul was guilty of having the Neuv Ir HaKoyanim wiped out. They weren't continuing in that. Now, again, there are Mephoshim who learn that, in fact, those based on Midrashim, that, in fact, those seven did participate in it. So in that case, then the question wouldn't really begin. But the Gemara is assuming over here that they didn't. Marsha goes on further and says, Mela, the five children of Michal may well have been Ketanim at this point. They may have been little kids, and little kids sometimes, Taka, the Gemara mentions, are caught up in the Averis of their fathers because they're not judged on their own, but they can be, their parents can be punished through losing them, Rahman al-Fan. But the question really is about the two sons of Ritzba Basaya. By definition, they have to have been already adults because, again, this is 30 odd years since Shaul was killed. So his children obviously have to be at least that age. So now the question is, how could David give them over to be killed seemingly against halacha? So the Gemara answers, Amar Rav Chiya bar Abba, Amar Rav Yochanan, mutav shete'okar ois achas min ha-Torah, better let one letter of the Torah be uprooted, meaning, so to speak, overridden and ignored for the moment, rather than making a public chil Hashem. Because otherwise, like this, people are going to say, the goyim are going to say, what kind of a people is this? They harassed and they caused trouble to the givonim, and now they don't even and here you have them, and they didn't even do anything to make it up to them afterwards. So therefore, so David realized in order to undo that chilul Hashem, he has to do that, and therefore in this case, that's going to mean temporarily overriding that din in the Torah. Why we're calling it Ois Achas when on the face of it it's one pasuk, it's a whole pasuk? A couple of Mephoshim talk about different possibilities. Maybe Taka doesn't mean literally one letter, but it means a whole. It's just using it loosely to mean a concept in Torah. The Maharal makes a point, for example, that here we're talking about temporarily overriding one single mitzvah. We're not talking about permanently, chas v'shalom, and we're not talking about the entire Torah. So relative to the entire Torah, it can be called one letter. But there are a couple of Mephoshim talk about various ways in which we can literally understand it to be one letter. It is a Hadas Charles. So actually, yeah, there are Mephoshim who explain that, yeah, it's not technically overriding the Torah at all. It's rather, like we said before, Din HaMalchus, where the king has the right to override, to do things that are necessary for the functioning of society. Right, I mentioned before, from the Malbim, for example, that's why David uses the expression Ani Etting. But what the Gemara is saying over here, according to that, is not that they're actually uprooting and ignoring something of the Torah, but at least it has the appearance of it. People who don't know better, who don't know this concept of Din HaMalchus, are going to wonder why you're doing that. And the answer is to undo the Chilul Hashem, it's worth doing that. Marsha, by the way, mentions earlier that when we talked about what happened to the Givonim when Noiv was destroyed, again, Rashi had learned that they lost their source of water and food because the Kohenim used to supply it to them. Marsha learned that actually no, because the Givonim at least could get their own water. What they lost was the source to be able to serve Hashem indirectly by bringing water and wood for the Mishkan. So now David is saying. So that means they themselves are concerned about the fact there was a chilul Hashem involved, that they themselves lost this chus, and therefore David realizes now we have to undo that chilul Hashem and instead make a kiddush Hashem by doing what the givonim want, even though they themselves are being cruel about it, and we can't allow them to intermarry into the Jewish people, v'chola, but nevertheless it still has to be done. A different other point also Mephoshim make a point is, to begin with, when the Givonim first joined up in the times of Yeshua, where, as we talked about yesterday, Yeshua and the Skenim had sworn to them in Hashem's name that they're not going to harm them. That was before they realized, when the Givonim were pretending to be from a faraway country and they want to make an alliance with the Jewish people. But nevertheless, even afterwards, they still had to keep the Shavua. And now, in other words, when Shaul had harmed them, then that was also a Chilul Hashem in the sense that he had been partially over on that Shavua. And therefore, again, David realizes that has to be taken care of.
The famine,
that's what we're saying. Well, the famine was for the whole Eretz Yisrael. You're asking.
How long? 30?
Three years, we said. 3 years. Yeah.
All of a sudden, at the end of the
30. Yeah. That's, we talked about yesterday a couple of possibilities why it is that Hashem waited so long. But yeah. The Aruch HaNer brings two possibilities. He said maybe by this time, most of the original generation who had been around at the time when the Givonim were first harmed were now gone, and now it's a new generation, and they still hadn't done anything about it yet, so it's time to do. And then also he gives another reason as well, having to do with 30 days that they should have mourned for Shaul, and Hashem waited for 30 years. Now, the pasuk continues, that Tikach Ritzba Basaya as a sack. Ritzba Basaya, who we said was the mother of two of these people who were killed, she took a sack, batatehu lar latsur, she leaned it against a rock over there in order to make like a lean-to for herself to protect herself and the bodies. Mitzchilas Kotzer, from the beginning of the harvest season, the Medrash says that the people were hanged on the first day of Chol HaMoed Pesach, to Zayin Nissen, which is the beginning of the harvest season in Eretz Yisrael. Ad nitach mayim aleihem min ha-shamayim, until rain fell on them from Shemayim, which is the beginning, which is during the fall, which is Cheshvan time. She wouldn't allow the birds of the birds of prey to rest on them by day, or the animal, the wild animals, to attack them at night. So Pashat, in other words, she stayed there for like 7 months from Nisan until Cheshvan, guarding the bodies to make sure that birds of prey and animals of prey don't get to them. And she used a sack to protect the bodies as best as possible, and also to protect herself from like the heat and the rain and whatever. Tosfos also brings the word Hatsur over here is very significant. The word Hatsur we also use of Hashem, Hatsur Tom and Paul. So it means Ritzpah did not complain. She might well have complained. Hayitochen, my two children, all I have left from Shaul, have been killed, and not even for anything that they did wrong. Nevertheless, she accepted Hashem's judgment. She said, Hatsur Tom and Paul, Hashem, everything that he does is right, and I accept his judgment. And now she stayed there, Pashut Mesiras Nefesh, for 7 months over there guarding the bodies. Now the question is, what kind of 7 months? Voksiv lo solden nivlos ala eitz. Doesn't the Pasuk say when a person is executed by Beis Din and they hang the body, and the Gemara and Sanhedrin discusses under what exactly are the dinim when they hang him, but whatever, there are such cases, then you're not allowed to leave the body on the gallows overnight. You have to take it down, and you have to take it down and bury it that day. So how are you talking? They're leaving these seven people hanging over there for 7 months. Again, Amar Rabbi Yechon Meshum Rabbi Shimon Yehi Tzadok, same thing. Mutav she'te'okar ois achas min ha-Torah, that David figured better to let one letter of the Torah be uprooted and overridden for the time being. V'yiskadish shem shemayim b'fahesya. Before it was to undo the chilul Hashem that had been done by harming the Givonim. Now fakir, David figured it'll make a kiddush Hashem b'fahesya. Shahoyu Ovrim Vashavim Omrim, passers by seeing the bodies hanging over there would say, Mativan Shalelu. People would ask, what are these bodies doing hanging over there? And people would tell them, Halol b'nei Malachim Haim. These are princes, these are sons of a king who were hanged. Uma also, so people would ask, what did they do that got them this punishment? And they would answer, Poshta Yadeh Begerim Gurim. They harmed Gerim Gurim. Gurim means like literally dragged in. So it means like inferior Gerim. Like these are not of the Givonim, are not even real honest to goodness Gerim, because they came in the first place, they tricked Yeshua and they tricked the Jewish people and whatever, and yet then they were accepted as Gerim, sort of like B'dieved. Omru, so now this would cause the Goyish pastors by to say, look at that. There's no other nation like the Jewish people that's worth joining. You see how they're taking their own princes and they're punishing and killing them because they harmed like the lowest class of people, the Gerim Gurim. And they would figure to themselves, Ma b'nei Malachim kach, if they do this even to princes, b'nei had yotas alachas kan lakama. How much more so if a plain yid harms a ger that they're going to hold them to account? Ma gerim gurim kach, and madach, they're doing it even for these inferior gerim, Yisrael alachas kan lakama. How much more so they would do it if one yid harms another? So they would realize that the Jewish people are an extremely moral people, that we don't let anything slide like that. So they were very impressed by that. So that's why it was worth leaving the bodies hanging there for all those months in order to make that public Kiddush Hashem. In fact, some of the Mefarshim say that's exactly the point. When the Pasuk says you're not allowed to leave the body hanging overnight, it says, Kikilas alekim toleri. Having a body hanging, a person is created B'Tselem Elokim, and it's a disgrace to Hashem that a person who's created B'Tselem Elokim should be hanging there. Here, Adarabah, it wasn't a disgrace. It was Adarabah, it was to make a Kiddush Hashem. So therefore, David allowed it. Miyad nitvas for Yisrael Meir v'chamishim elef. So immediately 150,000 Gerim joined the Jewish people at that time. Now, we learned earlier in the Masechta that they weren't accepting Gerim in the times of David and Shlomo. So it means, in other words, Tosfos explains, it doesn't mean there were official Bate Dinim who would accept them, but there were like, they were able to find like ad hoc Bate Dinim of simpler Jews who know the halachas, but they don't realize this point that people are being megayer for improper reasons, either because they might be wanting to join in the wealth and power of the Jewish people, and they would accept them, and b'dieved they're considered geirim. Marashah makes a different point. Again, since the Givonim's objection was that they hadn't been allowed to serve Hashem anymore in the Bes Mikdash, meaning that they were concerned about the Chilul Hashem that was caused by that. So therefore, when these 150,000 Goyim are coming, we can be sure that they're also motivated by Kiddush Hashem, because after all, that was the motivation for the whole thing in the first place. So all of them joined the Jewish people. Shenemar, As the pasuk says, "Vayhila Shlomo shivim elef noisei sabol or shmonim elef choitzer bahar." We find when Shlomo was getting ready to build the Beis Mikdash, he had 70,000. He had 70,000 people carrying burdens and 80,000 people quarrying stones. So that's 150,000. Where did he get them from? From Geirim. So the Gemara finishes off. The Dilma Yisrael Havu. What do you mean? Maybe these 150,000 were born Jews? And the answer is Loi Sakudai. Doch no, because the pasuk also says, "Umibnei Yisrael and nosan Shlomo oved." Shlomo did not have any of the born Jews serve as slaves. So if he has 150,000 people doing slave work, they have to be gated. Still, the Dilma Dungabalma, fine, so he didn't make them slaves. He hired the 150,000 Jewish workers. How does that tell you there were Gerim of that number? No, Elamei Hocha, you have a different pasuk in Divrei Yomim, when it also describes the building of the Beis Mikdash, by Yispo Shloima, Kolano Shema Gerim, Shloima counted all the Gerim who were in Eretz Yisrael, by Yitzoyim, Meiv HaChamishim Olaf, and he found them to be 150,000 and change, and then he put them to work as quarriers and porters for the construction of the Beis Mikdash. So we see clearly that all those people who were doing those heavy jobs were Geirim. Where did such a large number of Geirim come all at once is from this story, which had happened a few years earlier near the end of David's life.
They don't die afterwards?
What, the 150,000? No reason to say that they did.
Okay. They built the Beis Mikdash?
So they're the ones who did the actual... No, so they weren't the architects, but they were the ones who were doing the heavy jobs. They're the ones who were carrying the stone, who were quarrying the stones out of the mountain and hauling them and schlepping them from one place to the next.
That's why we have to give respect to again.
Yeah. All right. Yom Yom Mashiach HaGo'olach of Zion.
They all became Gerim not through a Besen?
So not through a Beis Din. If a person becomes a Ger through a Beis Din, it doesn't work. But they were Beis Din Shel Hadyotis. It was Bate Dinim, not the expert Bate Dinim, who would tell them, sorry, we're not accepting Gerim in these times of David and Shlomo, but rather Jews who are less knowledgeable than that. They know enough of the halachas to be able to have people in the Gaia, but not enough to realize that this isn't the time in Jewish history when we should be doing that. But again, according to Maharsha, maybe you don't need to say that because he makes the point that the Givonim B'chla were motivated by the Chilul Hashem of them losing their opportunity to serve in the Beis Mikdash, and therefore that these 150,000 were motivated by Kiddush Hashem as well, and that would be a legitimate reason even for the best qualified Beis Din to accept him. All right, Yom Yom Mashiach HaGo'ola. The Rebbe talks about the idea that nowadays we have the complete Yafutza Minasecha Chutza throughout the world, even in a way that people can understand in a Seichel. Even you have people are in the uttermost Chutza. You even have Pnimiyas HaTorah has been translated into Russian and all kinds of other languages, and you keep on having more. In fact, when the Rebbe said the Sicha in Tavshin Nun Aleph, they just for the first time printed a Tanya in Braille for blind people. So until then, you had Hafotza Samayonis, the people who were able to see. Now, for the first time, you had one that was printed also in a language for people who were in a script for people who can't see. All right. Shabbat shalom, everyone. Aloha.